Psalm 121 this morning. A message we've entitled Pilgrim Conversations. Psalm 121 is one of those well-known psalms, an oft-memorized psalm, but I trust that it will be impressed upon us with refreshed vigor this morning. Psalm 121, we've read it. Let's read it again. It's a song of ascent. He says, I will lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. You know, often when we think of those who've changed the course of history with their words, we'll often think of politicians or great philosophers. Within the Christian community, we often think of great preachers. As we think of those who've changed the world with just words, you might think of philosophers, Aristotle, or of Immanuel Kant, or Soren Kierkegaard. These guys changed the way the world saw reality just by words that they crafted. You think of great politicians of the past, whether it's Thomas Jefferson, who crafted probably the greatest document across the history of the known world, other than the Bible itself. Abraham Lincoln, who in just such short, pithy sentences caught and captured the heart of a nation. Or Ronald Reagan, who inspired hope in one of the times of great tension within the United States. You think of great preachers. There's Augustine, who kind of set the course for Christianity. Martin Luther during the Reformation that we've looked at so recently. Charles Spurgeon, who hasn't heard of Charles Spurgeon and the messages and the way that he turned a phrase because of his great love for God. All of these men changed the world in which they live, and they did so by the words that they spoke. But how many women do we know that changed the world by the words that they spoke? There's some, such as Harriet Beecher Stowe or Hannah Moore. They wrote their way into the conscience of an era, of an epoch, of a time. But I would suggest, and I think the Bible does as well, that the women's speeches that have changed the world the most are not so much that those that are recorded on the collective conscience of societies, but are those private conversations with sons and daughters who've grown to become agents of change and shapers of their time. Here other names rise to the surface, names like Susanna Wesley. You've heard of her, or at least you've heard of her sons. Perhaps Elizabeth Newton. You've sung the song of one of her son. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. The Bible tells us in Proverbs 18:21 that death and life are in the power of the tongue. And those who love it shall eat its fruits. Mom, I'm going to be talking to you in particular today. Our mothers among us. But understand, children, this is just as much for you as it is for your moms. Dads, this is just as much for us as it is for our wives. Because death and life is in the power of each of our tongues. But Mom, you in a special way are capable of shaping lives on a daily basis with words that you say. As I turn to Psalm 121, I can't help coming to this psalm without thinking of a certain lady in my life when I was in the fourth grade. Her name was Lillian Payne. She was my fourth grade teacher. She had been the dean of women at Pillsbury Baptist Bible College for years. And at the ripe old age of 63, I thought she was ancient. I know better now. Widowed early in life, she poured herself into us as her students. One of the
passages of Scripture that she had us memorize was Psalm 121. We memorized it. We brought it to a nursing home. We recited our portions of Scripture before the truly ancient or infirmed. And we all went home. But this psalm was stuck in my head ever from that day. I can read it in any translation, but I always hear it in the King James. It's just stuck there in that poetic language. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. We know how important that is, especially as we've been working through the book of Numbers. We've seen in the book of Numbers that the people are en route from Egypt to Canaan, and they're wandering around in the wilderness. They're doing life in the wilderness, and they're having to do life by faith. They don't do it well. More often than not, they'd live by sight rather than by faith. But God is teaching them there in the wilderness, en route to the promised land, walk by faith, not by sight. And it's interesting that it's in the wilderness that God gives them his word. As they're en route between two different worlds, we can easily see in the book of Numbers our pilgrim pathway marking the journey from earth to the promised land, heaven, as we walk by faith, not by sight. It's important as we do this life in the wilderness, between two worlds, the words that we speak are awfully important because the Bible reminds us, Jesus himself reminds us, that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So, Mom, the question is, as a pilgrim wandering in the wilderness, responsible for other pilgrims, what does your mouth reveal about your heart? What conversations are you having that is encouraging the lives of those around you en route with you to the promised land? What is your mouth betraying of your heart? How are you shaping those hearts to anticipate and to keep their eyes fixed on the promises of God, on the word of God, keeping their hearts tuned to hear that voice of God in the wilderness? That's an important question. Psalm 121 is a song of ascent, it says. That probably means that it was sung by the pilgrim of, or the children of Israel after they're in the promised land, each of them been given their own inheritance, and three times a year they would have to come to Jerusalem. They call them the pilgrim festivals. In fact, it's built into that word festival. It has the idea of traveling for celebration. And they would come down three times a year. Deuteronomy 16, verse 16 reminds us which festivals those are. Passover, Pentecost, and then the Feast of Tabernacles at the very end of their holiday season. They're in the seventh month of the year. But as they would travel, they would sing songs. We have some 12 of them here from Psalm 120 down to Psalm 132. These are songs of ascents because they would be going up, Jerusalem being the highest point within that region, wherever you went, from whatever direction, you would have to go up to Jerusalem. And as they would ascend, they would be singing these songs. Now, it's obvious as we read this psalm that it addresses the theme of fear. He says, I look to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord. He's the one who keeps. He helps. He keeps. These are themes that are developed throughout this psalm. There's a need of keeping. There's a need of help. It points us to this God who does the helping and does the keeping. This psalm also seems that the concerns come in the dark. As they're traveling, they would probably be stopping several different places along the way, depending on how far they were stationed from Jerusalem. And as they traveled, they would be stopping in places that were largely unfamiliar. They'd be in the hill country, there in Samaria, probably. Or if they came south from the Negev, there would be hills. It'd be a location that was dangerous, hot, dirty, but especially at night. And so it seems as there's this fear, it comes particularly at night. And we see that especially as it focuses on the fact that this God will never slumber. He'll never sleep. Don't worry, little pilgrim. Our God that we go to worship will never slumber. He'll never sleep. He's not afraid of these hills. He can see beyond what we can't see, and he'll keep us safe in our journey. I think the interesting thing, though, that in this psalm, it surfaces that one pilgrim is trying to convince another about these truths. Look at verse 1. I will lift up my eyes to the hills. From whence does my help come? My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Now, verse 3. He will not let not my foot be moved. He will not let your foot be moved. Look down to verse 5. The Lord is your keeper. My help comes from the Lord. The Lord, the same Lord who's your keeper. And as one pilgrim is traveling along with another, one is speaking to the other pilgrim, and they're trying to convince this pilgrim beside them, probably at night in the hill country of Judea. Don't worry, fellow pilgrim. We're going to make it safely home, because our God is bigger than the hills. And he's not just my helper, but he's yours as well. I don't think that it's very much of a stretch of an imagination to picture a mother and a child perhaps who's afraid of the dark, as they circle the tents, as they're sitting around that campfire late at night, about ready to be tucked into bed. In fact, this has been called the even song of the pilgrims. We might think of it as a pilgrim's lullaby. Or maybe, more generically, more broadly, it could be referred to as just a pilgrim conversation. It's the kind of conversation between a mother and a child that potentially shapes not only the direction of a single child, but even alters the course of history. So, as we dive into this psalm this morning, the proposition is very simple. Mother, as a pilgrim, speak truth to help other pilgrims on their journey. But even as you hear the poignancy of that directive, Dad, you know that that's true for you as well. Dad, as a pilgrim, speak truth to help other pilgrims on their journey. Teens, as a pilgrim, speak truth to help other pilgrims on their journey. Children, speak truth as a pilgrim to help other pilgrims on their journey. It's a one-size-fits-all, especially if you belong to him. But Mom, particularly you, the shaper, the molder of lives that are tender, that are being bent by the words that you speak. So the question is legitimate. How do I do this? How do I engage in pilgrim conversations? How do I construct meaningful, life-shaping conversations around the Word of God, around the character of God, around the person? How do I do that? Glad you asked, because I think this psalm helps us to see three features of pilgrim conversations. And in context, we're going to think of it as a mother talking to a child en route to Jerusalem to worship together. But these are conversations that don't just happen three times a year. These are conversations that have to mark our journey, because really, this journey is symbolic of a larger journey. This journey, going to Jerusalem, going to the place of worship, going to the place of God's presence, as many times as I make it, speaks of the larger journey between now and then. Well, I will see him face to face. Even as we looked at in Psalm chapter 17 this morning, when I will wake up in his presence, when I'll be with him forevermore. There's three features, I believe, that this psalm brings out for us that shape what pilgrim conversations are. The first is this. Pilgrim conversations seek to pass on what is personally possessed. We see that in verses 1 and 2. We see that let's call her the mother, the one who owns this for herself, speaking to the child. As she looks out with the child there in the dark at those hills surrounding them on their campsite, they're hearing strange noises. They're seeing a different landscape. They're thinking about what lies there in the hills, what lurks there in the hills. And Mom doesn't say, There's no hills. Mom says, there's hills out there. She acknowledges that there's really something that is threatening. There's really something that's dangerous. She says, you know what? As we're camped here, I see the hills too, child. I'm not going to pretend they're not there. But let's think about them for just a minute. We could focus on the fact that this is unfamiliar territory. This isn't our backyard. We could focus on the fact that there are bad people in the world who are lurking and waiting and looking for opportunity to waylay those who are in transit from one destination to another. We could think about the bandits that anticipate the holiday travelers. We could think about the animals lurking and hiding in their dens and just waiting for night so that they can come out and do the hunting. Those are real dangers. I'm not going to pretend that they don't exist. But as she personally acknowledges the threat, it prompts her to the reality of seeking assistance. You know what, my child? These are real threats. And they're threats that are bigger than me. You know, it's no shame in life to acknowledge that life is too big for me to do alone. I think probably that's a good reason why this might be a mom who's saying these things. Because dads, they say, life's not too big. Just man up. You can handle it. Moms say, you know what? Life's too big. We need help. Where are we going to look for it? And as she looks at the threat, she acknowledges that it's real. She says, you know what? We need help. We need somebody from the outside who's going to protect, who's going to take care of us. We need somebody from the outside who's bigger, who's stronger than we are. Yes, Daddy's over there in the tent, but we need somebody even bigger and stronger than Daddy. We need God. And as she stops and personally acknowledges the threat, there's a question that surfaces. I lift up my eyes to the hills. I see them. I've thought many times about what's on the other side of those hills, what's lurking in those hills. But let me ask a question. From where does my help come? My dear child, where does Mommy's help come from? And the child would probably very simply, naively say, well, Mommy, your help comes from God. Well, that's right. That's the good answer. That's the right answer, child. I'm glad you said that. My help comes from the Lord. I think speaking this question aloud teaches the importance of talking to ourselves. A child needs to know how to work through asking those questions and knows that Mom and Dad struggle with the same things that we struggle with. Mom, are you ever afraid? Are you ever afraid of what the future holds? You ever afraid of that thing that's just around the corner? Shoot, Dad, you ever afraid? Of course you are. I think it's good to talk with our children about the real threats, the real things that are bigger than ourselves, and then working through and talking through, well, Dad, Mom, how do you wrestle with these things? Well, you know what? I can't just let my feelings take over. I've got to speak truth, and I've got to speak truth to me. So let's speak truth to ourselves at this moment. And speaking aloud teaches the importance of speaking truth to ourselves. But speaking this question aloud also teaches the importance of asking the right questions. Not, what's out there waiting for us? The right question is, just a minute, where has my help come from in the past? My help. My past. Where does it come from routinely? Where can I go to get help on a regular basis? Why does my help come from this source? Where have I learned that help doesn't come from? And sometimes being farther down the road as a mom, as a dad, you've looked for help in the wrong places. You can say, my child, that's an empty cistern. Don't go there. My child, keep your feet on this path. My child, go to this source because this is the only source that's worth going to. This is the only place where help can come from. This is the only place where somebody is bigger than the problems that you face at the moment. The mom personally acknowledges the threat. She personally considers the question. Then she personally expresses her confidence in God. My help comes from the Lord. And you'll see there in verse 2, it's the covenant name of Yahweh, Israel's covenant redeemer. There's a focus in this name on the goodness of God, the redeeming God, the God who reached in to the land of slavery and drew out a people for himself, who distinguished them from all others, so that all others through them might be blessed. This is Israel's covenant redeemer. It focuses on the goodness of this God and the particularity of his purpose. Child, my help comes from my covenant God. You've heard the story. When we were in Egypt, God reached down and he drew us out. He drew us to himself. And because he has a purpose for me, he holds on to me. He's going to use me. He's got plans for me. And he promises that as I do life with him, he's going to be there for me. He has a purpose for my life. Romans 9 reminds us what that covenant relationship looked like with the Israelites in particular. These are the Israelites, Paul says. To them belongs the adoption. They're sons of God, God calls them. To them belongs the glory, the Shekinah that comes down on top of Mount Sinai, that later transfers down into the midst of the camp, that lashes out against Nadab and Abihu, that reaches down with hailstones on Israel's enemies. This is the glory that belongs to us. Theirs is the covenants. Theirs is the giving of the law. Theirs is the worship. Theirs are the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from their race, according to the flesh, is the Messiah, the one who is God over all and blessed forever. Where does my help come? My help comes from my covenant God. And because he is mine, I'm his. And because I'm his, I matter to him. Not that I'm anything of myself, but for whatever reason, because he loved me, he set his affection upon me, he's not going to change his mind. And because I'm his, he's mine. And all that is his character, his strength, his holiness, his reputation, his power, it's mine. It's at my disposal because I belong to him and he belongs to me. Verse 2, my help comes from my covenant redeemer who is maker of heaven and earth. Not only is he the covenant redeemer, but he's creation's sovereign creator. The fact that he's Yahweh, Israel's God, focuses on God's goodness to a particular group of people that he has a purpose for. But when it speaks of God as the creator, it speaks of one who is sovereign globally. Keep your fingers here. Go back to Job chapter 38. Job chapter 38. The Lord answers Job out of the whirlwind and says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man, Job. I'll question you. Make known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined the earth's measurements? Oh, surely you know. Who stretched out the line upon the earth? On what were the earth's bases sunk? Who laid the earth's cornerstones? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Who shut in the sea with doors? Verse 16, have you entered into the springs of the sea? How about verse 19? Have you known the way of the dwelling of light? Verse 22, have you entered into the storehouses of the snow? Verse 25, can you direct the torrents of the rain? Can you chart out a path for the thunderbolt? Verse 28, does the rain have a father? How is it generated? Verse 31, can you bind the chain of the Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you put the stars in place? Verse 35, can you send forth lightnings? Verse 39, Can you hunt for prey for the lion? God just takes creation and he marches through creation and he says, listen, I'm the God who can do this. I'm sovereign over snow, rain, thunder, lightning, sea, sky, earth, stars, animals, man. You get the point? Now let me ask you something. Child, what do you have a problem with? Is it as big as the stars? Let me show you a solution. Do you have a problem with a person? Let me show you a solution. Do you have a problem with animals? Let me show you a solution. Let me introduce you to the one who made the stars, who made all men, who made all animals, who directs, who guides, who shepherds, who plans, who sees, who knows, who prepares, who protects, who feeds. This is the God of creation. There's not one part of anything that you can touch, taste, see, or feel that he doesn't already own, possess, direct, and guide. And here's the thing. He's going to do these things with you in mind because of his great love for you. There's a focus in this creation of God on the greatness of God and the breadth of his dominion. Earlier, focusing on the Lord, it's the goodness of God focused on a particular people. Here, it's the greatness of God in all of his majesty over all things everywhere. This is a pretty amazing combination. The greatness and the goodness of God, this one brings together and shows a fellow pilgrim, this is how we need to think. Because everything is his, it must do as he pleases. There's not one thing in my life that's going to happen that isn't there on purpose. We've said it this way several times. In my life as a believer, only the right wrong things happen. Do bad things happen to believers? Absolutely. But only the right bad things happen. Only the good bad things happen. Because everything happens in my life on purpose, and he says that purpose is very good. That's a good place for us to start. Pilgrim conversations seek to pass on what they personally possess. Mom, here's a little secret. You can't give to your kids a faith that you don't possess. You can't give a love for God to your kids that you don't possess. You can't give a joy to your kids that you don't possess. You want your kids to look a certain way, to think a certain way? Then, Mom, it starts with you. Dad, you want your wife to do this? Then you'd better get it in your life as well so that your wife can see it, so that your kids can see it, and so on. Number two, a second feature of pilgrim conversations is this. A pilgrim conversation seeks to clarify by removing complexities. I want you to understand, if we think of this in light of a parent-child relationship, as these pilgrims are traveling, what we're not talking about is a simplistic approach to life, a naivety. What we're talking about is something simple, as in not complicated. I either have joy or I have lack of joy, right? What the Bible does and what these pilgrim conversations do is they peel back all of the periphery of life and it boils life down to some very basic components. We need this. We do it as parents so very often. When Rand Hummel was with us, what is obedience? Obedience is right away, all the way, without complaint. Or as he says it, it's quickly, sweetly, and complete, right? Completely. You got it. Okay. Even our sixth graders are saying it in the back row over there. What is obedience? Obedience that isn't quick isn't obedience. Obedience that isn't all the way isn't obedience. Obedience that's grumpy and complaining isn't obedience. Obedience has to look like these things. We do that as parents for our kids. I like how Susanna Wesley did it for her sons, who were already preachers. She said, "My sons, what is sin? Whatever weakens your reason, whatever impairs the tenderness of your conscience, obscures your sense of God, or takes off your relish of spiritual things, that, my son, is sin for you, however innocent it may be of itself. Anything that quiets your passion for God is a sin. So don't get caught up with it." What this mother does, what this pilgrim does for a fellow pilgrim, is it takes all the complexities, the strangeness of the surroundings, the threats that are lurking in the dark, and it boils truth down to three basic realities. Reality number one is this: there's God. There's God. In fact, verse 3, "He will not let your foot be removed." The idea, the "he" there, is this God, the Lord, the covenant redeemer, and the sovereign creator. He's the one who won't suffer your foot to be moved. "He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep." He has a title. He's the keeper of Israel. This identifies God as a careful God. The word "keep" there is to watch, to guard, to protect. It has the idea of guarding a treasure or something of significant value. It's used of a gardener tending to his garden with great care, getting down and making sure the stems aren't bent or broken. It's plucking out the weeds. It's pulling back the shade. It's tending to each plant specifically and individually. It's used of a shepherd. It's used of a steward of a house who's been entrusted and oversees the household, looking over all of the details very carefully. That's the picture that's used of God. He's the keeper, the watcher, the guardian, the protector. What's implied in this title is that this God isn't just a bystander. He's not in a bleacher tending from a distance. "Oh, yep, I see that weed. Oh, I see that detail. Things are going to go bad. I can just tell." He's not sitting there with a remote on the couch watching on Netflix. "Yep, can see it coming." The idea of a watcher means he's actively caring. He's actively protecting. He's actively defending. He's involved. He's watching, and he's there to make sure that something doesn't happen that's bad. Or he's there to make sure that something does happen that's good. That's what this watching has the idea of. It's a watchfulness that's alert, it's ready, it's active. So it starts out with this God. It identifies him as alert, identifies him as active, it identifies him as attentive. It's not only that he doesn't sleep. Verse 4, "Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep." And there are two words. The first word there has the deeper meaning, to be in the deep snoring phase of sleep. The other one has the idea of restfulness and just almost a fitful slumber. But the idea is God never falls into a deep sleep. In fact, he doesn't even doze off for just a minute, like you do when you've been driving home. You get done with a long semester. You're going to just blaze through the night. You pray for your kids as they're at the wheel because you know how easy it is to fall asleep, just to doze, just for a second. God doesn't even do that. He not only sees, but he looks out for the well-being of all that he claims as his own. Reality number one is God. A God who's watching, attentive, alert, and active. Reality number two is the people who belong to God. End of verse 4. "Behold, he who keeps Israel." The one who's redeemed Israel. The one who's made covenant with Israel. These are the people of God. These are the ones that God calls his segola, his treasure. The ones who are a part of his treasure house, his inner chamber, his junk drawer, top drawer kind of treasure that nobody else touches by pain of death. This is what God is protecting for himself. He keeps Israel. He keeps everyone who belongs to him. Exodus chapter 6, verse 7 says, "I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. God's care of his people speaks more of him than it does even of them. As God begins to work out his plan in redeeming Israel there in the book of Exodus, we looked at it just a little bit this morning, but in chapter 6, verse 7, 7 verses 5 and 17, chapter 8, verse 22, over and over and over again throughout the book, he says, "By this you shall know that I am Yahweh. By this you shall know who I am and what it means for me to be your God." Well, what are the things that God does on behalf of those who belong to him? Well, he saves them. He rescues them. He reaches in and claims them as his own. And he does it in a magnificent way. He does it so that, as Mike said this morning, he makes it an eye-opener. He draws attention. He makes it obvious. He causes it to stand out. God reaches in and he saves his people. He rescues them. He reaches in and he judges his enemies. He distinguishes his people from his enemies so that when judgment comes, judgment falls on enemies and judgment does not fall on those who belong to him. God makes known who belongs to him and gains glory over his enemies. He grants his presence to his people. By all of these things, he's telling his people, this is what it means for me to be yours. I want to be with you. I want to be close to you. I want to fight your battles. I want to get you out of troubles. I want to feed you. I want to distinguish you. I want to protect you. I want to wrap my arms around you and call you mine and give myself to you. Israel is kept by God. And what's implied in this is that God keeps not only Israel as a whole, but God keeps everyone inside of Israel, is the idea. I like in reading through Spurgeon's notes, he says, "The shepherd of the flock is the shepherd of each sheep." So it's not that the shepherd just watches over the flocks by night. Yep, there's a whole bunch of them. He's counting them. When you drive by Steve's farm, you look out in the field and you see a bunch of little sheep out there running around. Steve sees which sheep are there. That's the idea behind this word here. This God keeps Israel, the whole group of them, all of them that belong to him. How does he do that? By taking care of everyone inside that group that belongs to him. My child, here's the truth. There is a God. He's big. He's active. He's powerful. He's real. There is a group of people that God cares for because they belong to him, and he distinguishes and gains glory by his protection of his people. Here's reality number three, my child. Are you a part of this group? Do you belong to God? Can you say that he is mine? I am his. Well, today, on this side of the cross, we only become God's not because of the fact that he's our creator, though he owns us from the very beginning. He designed us. He made us in the womb. He made our bones. He made our brains. He knows everything about us. He gave us our personalities. But that's not what makes me God's. What makes me God's in a covenant way is that I've received his gift of salvation. Jesus Christ died on a cross to take away my sins. God didn't just love the whole world, but God loved me inside this world as a sinner who had personally rebelled against this God. And what the mother does for the child, she brings it down to this point and says, "Child, there's a big God who takes care of all of his people. Are you a part of his people? If so, this God's going to take care of you." And she boils down all of these threats. She boils down all of the possibilities. She boils down all of the realities to these simple realities. A big God who takes care of his people. And if you are a part of his people, this God will take care of you. What's true of all who belong to God must be true of you if you belong to God. That's why this second half of this psalm is filled with all those second person pronouns. He's my help. He's my help. Go back to verse 3. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade. The sun will not strike you. The Lord will keep you from evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out, your coming in. If this is true, that there's really a God who's big and sufficient and takes care of everyone who belongs to Him, if you belong to Him, He will take care of you. The third feature of pilgrim conversations is this. Pilgrim conversations seek to connect real life problems with bigger than life realities. I think this is important. The psalm points us to our comprehensive, intimate security. This security is comprehensive. You look at all the different parallels or the different spectrums that he lays out for us in this psalm. These are more than just poetic. He's piling up these ends of realities in order to try to draw something out for his people. He says he's the maker of heaven and earth. That is, there's no realm over which he's not sovereignly working for your good. In all of heaven or all of earth, there's not a realm outside of God's sovereignty. And if you belong to him, he sovereignly has designed and purposed to do you good. We see there in verse 6, the sun will not strike you by day or the moon by night. That is, there's no time in which God is not sovereignly working for your good. There's no realm that he's not looking for your good, and there's no time where he's not purposing your good. And it cites the specific dangers, the dangers of the day, the dangers of the night, the heat stroke, being struck by the moon. We call it moonstruck, or we call it lunacy, is the idea. But it's not speaking specifically only of heat stroke and only of being struck, moonstruck. It's the idea of whatever dangers lurk in the day and whatever dangers lurk in the night. There's not a time that you're going to find yourself outside of God's purposed good will for your life. Mom, do I need to impress upon you how important that is to have as a reality for you? A stabilizer, a rudder, an anchor in the time of storm? Because there's going to come times when your kids grow up that you don't have answers for, and you have to go back to the answers that you know to be true. There's a good God who cares for his people, and I'm one of them. And I don't know anything beyond that, but I know that for sure. And I'm holding on to that to be true. There's not a time that God is not working for your behalf. He says down in verse 7. The Lord will keep you from all evil. That's a pretty comprehensive term. That is, there's no power that can overturn God's sovereign working for your good. Mike referenced it this morning again, Ephesians chapter 6, verse 18. My brothers, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Well, isn't that encouraging? My child, there's a demon world out there that wants to work you evil. But guess what? There's a God who's bigger. Greater is he who is in you than he who is of the world. Do you believe it? I believe it up here, don't we? Okay. I have to talk to myself to keep believing it right here so that I walk by faith, not by sight. Now, this isn't just a simplistic band-aid given by a mom in the dark with raiders in the hills. Listen to, this is an extensive reading from Eugene Peterson, but listen to how he puts this. No literature is more realistic and honest in facing the harsh facts of life than the Bible. At no time is there the faintest suggestion that the life of faith exempts us from difficulties. But what it does promise is preservation from all the evil inherent in those difficulties. All the water in the oceans cannot sink a ship unless it gets inside, nor can all the trouble in the world harm us unless it gets within us. The only serious mistake that we can make when illness comes, when anxiety threatens, when conflicts disturb our relationships with others, the only mistake that we can make is to conclude that God has gotten bored looking after us and has shifted his attention to a more exciting Christian, or that God has become disgusted with our meandering obedience and decided to let us fend for ourselves for a while, or that God has gotten too busy fulfilling prophecy in the Middle East to take time to sort out the complicated mess that we've got ourselves into. That's the only serious mistake we can make. It's the mistake that Psalm 121 prevents, the mistake of supposing that God's interest in us waxes and wanes in response to our spiritual temperament. Mom, do you ever feel like God is only interested in you when you're winning the victories, when you're winning the battle, when you didn't blow it? Is that the only time you're interested in your child? Or are you particularly interested then in them when they don't? It's the same with our God. It's the same with our God. You must be convinced that he is particularly interested in you. He will keep you from all evil. There's not a power on earth that has the power to do you bad in all the bad that will happen to you and to your family. We go to him. So Romans chapter 8 reminds us, we know that all things work together for good for those who love God, those who are called according to his purpose. But you keep reading the rest of that chapter. So what shall separate us from the love of God? Shall tribulation? No. Will we experience it? Yes. Distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, sword? No, and all these things were more than conquerors. Because I'm sure that neither death nor life, angels, rulers, things present, things to come, powers, height, depth, anything in all of creation can separate me from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. This is a comprehensive security. I'll protect you from all evil. He says, he will protect your life, verse 7. He will keep your life. That is, the word here is nephesh. It has the idea of the life, the soul, the breath, the spirit. It speaks of the totality of the person, all that one is. There's no time in which God is not working for your good. There's no realm in which God is not working for your good. There's no power that can overturn his sovereign working for your good. And there's no part of your life, body, soul, spirit, personality, education, relationship, mental, spiritual, physical, there's not a part of your life that God is not sovereignly working your good. See, you don't know the aches, the pains that I have. God does. And he promises that he's using every part of your life for good. Verse 8, the Lord will keep your going out and your coming in. That is, there's no place that you can find yourself that he's not sovereignly working good for you. You ever moved? And in a new place, you run up to new problems with new people, new situations, and you say, you know what? I wish I was back in Kansas. You ever thought that? You ever been there? Okay. Guess what? The same God of Kansas is the same God of the new place. He's just moved you to a different location. He's not a different God. There's not a place that you can go that God isn't God in your life. That's important. It's important as you send your kids off to college. There's not a place where God isn't God in their lives. We don't get Kyle home for the summer. He gets an internship this summer. We've been praying for that for 2 years. But that means we don't get Kyle home for the summer. But you know what? There isn't a place where Kyle can go where God isn't God in his life. That's an important truth to keep in mind. At the very end, one last spectrum. He will keep you from this time forth and even forevermore. Put a pin right here on the timeline and then draw it to eternity. Now, if you can find yourself between now and forever, God's in control there. Oh, stink. What about yesterday? Okay. Put it back to yesterday. God was always in control, and there's never a point on the spectrum when God's not going to be working in your life for good. This is a comprehensive security. It's an intimate security. He says, understand, my child, he who keeps you will never slumber. He's ever watchful because he's intimately concerned for you, is the idea. He's your keeper. He's your guardian. He's your protector. Why? Because 1 Peter 5, verse 7, casting all our cares on him because... Okay, do you really think he does? He says he does. He cares for you. Mom, you know what that feels like. You know what that looks like. You know the heart tug on your heart's strings. That's what God has in place for you. It says, the Lord is your shade on your right hand. He's ever protective because he's intimately present. The idea is a protective covering. It's like the covering of the wings that we looked at in Deuteronomy chapter 32 this morning. The idea of God spreading out his wings, protecting us. The shield would be in the left hand. The sword would be in the right hand. He says, God will be your shield on your which hand? On your right hand, where you don't have a shield. Because you're busy fighting the battles. You're busy trying to keep up with kids. Busy trying to keep up with life. Busy trying to keep up with work. Busy trying to keep up with... And God is there protecting you in the midst of your being exposed to all these tough things in life. My friend, this is a comprehensive security. It's an intimate security, but it's real, real security. He will not let your foot be moved, he says there at the very beginning. Verse 3, he will not let your foot be moved. Mike referenced this. It's the idea of slipping. It's the idea of tottering, staggering, being shaken so that your foot is dislodged. This is a particular danger in the hill country there in Judea. Rocky terrain, especially in the dark. This is the doctrine, it's sometimes referred to as the preservation or the perseverance of the saints. The idea is that God's saints can persevere because it's God's saints that he preserves. So as a pilgrim, God will not allow your foot to slip off the path that leads you home. My child, let's look at those hills. Are they dangerous? Yes. The dangers that lurk out there are bigger than you and they're bigger than me. We need help, don't we? Where are we going to look for help? We're going to look to God. The God who made everything. And the God who reached into it all and chose us out. So that he could pour out his good purposes in our life. And bring others to him through his purposes in our life. Now my child, I want you to understand, this big God takes care of everybody who belongs to him. Do you? Yes, Mom. Then because you belong to God, here's what he's going to do. Because he loves you with an everlasting love, he's watching over you all night. When other enemies are awake, your defender is awake as well. He's protecting you. He's watching you. He's caring for you. He has a purpose for you. And there's not a point in life where you're going to slip off the path until he brings you all the way home. You know, the two women that we referenced above, Susanna Wesley and Elizabeth Newton, they couldn't be more different in the types of moms that they were. One left a nonconformist church to join the Church of England. The other left the Church of England in order to join a nonconformist fellowship. One married a preacher. The other married a sea captain. One raised 19 children. The other one raised but one. One was robust in health and strong in spirit. The other one lacked physical strength and was of a weak disposition. One lived a long life. The other died of tuberculosis at the age of 27. One received assurance of her salvation late in life. The other rested in her salvation to an early grave. One lived to see her two boys become nationally renowned preachers. The other one died not knowing if her son would ever come to faith in Jesus Christ. Nonetheless, both ladies raised men who loved God tenaciously and whose lives touched others and in turn changed the world around them. How did they do it? These moms built into their lives pilgrim conversations. The one set aside time daily to personally instruct each one of her 19 children. The other one devoted what little time she had in order to teach her child to read and to instill in him the catechisms and hymns of the faith. The one spent a lifetime speaking truth into her children's lives through frequent letters. The other one impacted her son from beyond the grave with the prayers that he heard her pray over him as just a child. Mom, don't waste the time that you have with your children. It's so short. It's so little. As a pilgrim, speak truth to help other pilgrims on their journey. And as you do, you're shaping not just the future of a child, but you're shaping a future for the glory of God. And you don't know where that's going to stop. You don't know where that trajectory is going to go. He says, like arrows, you let it go, and God's going to determine the influence you have.